Here we go. Welcome to Speaking From Water, episode 55. And all of these Speaking From Waters are extremely special. You know how stoked I am at each Speaking From Water podcast. But today, guys, is extra, extra special. We have with us one of the world's greatest contemporary swim coaches on the line. He's also one of my lifelong friends. We've been together since 2001, and he's fresh off the Olympics. He's the coach of Cam McElroy, and his name is Tim Lane. Tim, welcome to Speaking From Water.
Hey, mate. How are you? It's an absolute pleasure to be here with you, dude.
Tim, this has been a long time coming. I've been wanting to get you on my podcast for ages, but you were focused like a laser beam for the past 2 years, really, with your athlete. And everything came to fruition a few weeks ago with a gold medal in the 50 freestyle. First of all, congratulations.
Thanks, mate. I appreciate it. It was a very special moment, one that I'll certainly never forget. And honestly, just a privilege to be a part of, and definitely a lot of gratitude and appreciation from my end. And I appreciate the kind words, maybe overplaying the accolades just a little bit, but coming from you, as we said, like, you know, we've been mates over half our lives now, which is crazy to think about. And it's been awesome to be able to share it with close friends and family and people that have supported me along the way and from afar as well. So and a huge congrats to you and everything that you've been able to accomplish over the last 20 years as well.
Well, Tim, I'm super proud of you, and we're going to get into our history, your history as to how you got to this point, and more of the Olympic experience. And I kind of want to start there, really. How has it been coming off such a success into this new world you're living in? I can only imagine you've been doing lots of interviews. People are wanting to talk to you. What's the nature of your feelings?
Yeah, it's probably a little bit mixed. I mean, by and large, life just goes on. It's pretty normal for me. You know, even though I'm working with Cam in a very individualized capacity, you know, I've got a program here, a swimming program that I run with, you know, a couple of hundred kids and their families and athletes of all ages and ability levels. So it's a pretty big job. And for me, as soon as the Olympics were done, it was fly straight back here to Brisbane. Obviously get back to my wife, Kristen, and my two boys, Parker and Sully, and spend some time with them, which was really important. I know they missed me a lot while I was gone, and I missed them a lot as well. So being able to get home and get back to the program and all the other athletes that I coach, and also the family was really special, and be able to celebrate with them in our own way, was awesome as well. The general support from, you know, I'm employed by a school in Brisbane, a private girls' school, Somerville House. So to get back into the school community and then obviously our swimming club community and a little bit of the wider community as well has been really, really great. You don't really realize how many people are back home sort of cheering for you and supporting you. So yeah, it's been a pretty good transition back. As I said, not much time off, just straight back into it and just keep pushing forward.
What did your family say? I know your family well. What was the general reception when you got home?
Oh, look, I guess in this day and age, you've just got so much access and communication with your family and your friends wherever you are in the world. So it was probably a little bit more ongoing and fluid as the whole experience took place. You know, I'll start with my mum, who's been my biggest supporter in anything that we've ever done throughout life. You know, my mum and dad really well, obviously. You got to know how supportive and just how caring they are as people. So, I mean, to just be able to share it with them and get some lovely messages from mum throughout the weeks and the campaign and dad as well. And then even my brother and sister, Pat and Kiara, and a wider family of cousins. Just so many different messages and so much support from them. And it's just cool to be able to share an experience as unique as this with them, and they're kind of along for the journey as well in their own way.
Well, I was very honored to be texting with you the day it happened. I watched it live here in the United States. It was like 2 in the afternoon, and I brought the whole family around the TV. They know you well. We have lore stories about Tim Lane, and you're there. You're watching it live, obviously. And Dressel comes walking out. The American, he's stacked. He's got the American tattoos just ripped to pieces. And I was like, dang, that dude looks like he's got it. Like, I don't know about this for my boys. And give us your point of view from that moment. Like, what was going on in your head? I know you guys were hyper focused. Take us there.
Yeah, it's a really good point you bring up. The probably like no other event at the Olympics, like the 50 freestyle, in my opinion is certainly one of the premier events. It's unique in the sense that it's the shortest race. So you're literally going against, you know, for Cam, he's up against seven of the other fastest men in the world and in that meet. So with that comes a lot of interest from the crowd. It's short, sharp, it's fast. Throw into the fact this year being in France, how parochial the crowd was. You know, we're looking at, I don't know, 18, 20,000 people in there just going absolutely wild. The French swimmer that was in that final, Florent Manadou, who was the 2012 Olympic champion, he also medaled in 2016 and 2021, which no one had ever done that across three consecutive Olympics, let alone trying to do it at four. So he came out like, he was one of the first to come out. He got the crowd going with like the slow clap with what they do at the athletics. Caleb came running out like an NFL linebacker for the Super Bowl. You know, the Ben Proud, who was in lane four, comes out and he just takes forever and just like dictates the pace of when the race is going to start by getting changed slowly, putting his cap on, taking his time. So there's just kind of this incredible build-up as it takes place. But just sort of to backtrack from that a little bit, you know, that point in time as Cam goes into the call room and then goes out onto the blocks for that 50 freestyle is really a culmination of all of the things that led into that. And preparation for that moment is obviously key. And I think for the general viewer or even family, friends of Cam's and mine and supporters, it can be quite an anxious moment because you don't get to see behind the scenes as what's happening. And it's like wildly out of your control. So you're supporting a guy that you've really got, you know, very little about their preparation, their headspace, what's taken place in the days and the weeks before that, what their experience are. You know, it was Cam's fourth Olympics. So he's had three other Olympic experiences that weren't what he wanted them to be. So there was a lot at play, but a couple of hours before the final, Cam and I sit down and we had a coffee, and going into that conversation as a coach, you're never quite sure what to expect or how your athlete's feeling. But Cam sat down and instantly just put, look, I have a lot of trust and confidence in him, but it was like exponentially tripled when I sat down with Cam and he just said to me, look, I feel as I've checked off every box that needed to be checked off. I've got a lot of satisfaction in knowing that. And really tonight, I'm okay with any outcome. And for me, just that pre-acceptance of an outcome by Cam in this moment said everything that needed to be said. And we ended up just sitting there for 20 minutes in perfect silence because, you know, we were both, I guess, just really, really comfortable. And he was definitely ready for the moment. Fast forward maybe to 20 or 30 minutes before that race, and we were walking under the scaffolding to get to the call room for the Olympic final. You kind of got to walk from the warm down pool under some scaffolding through the stands. And it's this little bit of a tunnel, and the call room's got, you know, seven of the other fastest men in the world in there waiting. And it's always described as, you know, kind of the jungle, and you've got to go in there and try to be king of the jungle while you get held there in this tiny space for 15 minutes and supposed to go in there and, you know, be full of confidence and really own that space. And right before we got there, Cam just sort of leaned into me and said, mate, just before there's an outcome attached to tonight, just want to let you know You know, wouldn't be here without you. It's been just a pleasure to have you on this journey with me, and I appreciate everything you've done. And for me, I actually started to get a little bit emotional, and I was thinking, like, hold it together, just hold it together now. We've gotten this far. And I quickly turned to Cam and said sentiments along the same lines, you know, like, mate, I definitely wouldn't be here without you either. It's been a hell of a journey. And, you know, it's more than the swimming side of things. It's been a pleasure to get to know you as a man and get in there and have some fun. And then Cam turned to me and said to me, holy dooly, I'm getting a little bit emotional here, mate. And I was like, me too, quick, go, you know. And it was strange. If you had told me that's how our last conversation would have been before an Olympic final, I wouldn't have expected it to get emotional and sentimental quickly like that. But I think at the heart of it was just like the gratitude and the appreciation that we have for each other and the moment. And it was really nice because usually all of those really nice things get said after an outcome, usually a successful outcome. But to be able to say those pre-outcome kind of meant the world to me, showed the character of Cam and definitely highlighted the strength of our relationship. And from that point on, Cam goes into the call room. I go and sit in the coach's box. I sat next to a coaching friend of mine from the University of Tennessee. He's the head coach down there, Matt Kredich. And while I was waiting for some of the other Australian coaches to come out, and he's like, you know, if you want to spend 15, 20 minutes with just an incredibly quality human, Matt's your guy. And he had a boy in the final as well, Jordan Crooks, who was next to Cam. And Jordan's from the Cayman Islands. And Matt and I just sat there, talked a little bit about life. He's got some incredible experience and perspectives on a number of things. And he's a great swimming mind. So we talked a little bit about swimming. And again, to go back to where we started, the confidence and trust that I had in Cam, that he could get up and do what he'd already done 1,000 times in practice and executed on the biggest stage was super high. So there was just a really unusual level of calm that comes along with knowing that, again, that satisfaction, you've turned every stone over that you want to turn over. Now get out there and do what your body's prepared to do. So for me, very little anxiety, very calm, and just kind of like a nice Zen moment, just waiting for that final to take place.
And when he touched to win, what was that feeling like? And tell us where your head went.
Yeah, it's funny because, you know, for us, we're obviously working towards an outcome. And, you know, Cam had a clear idea of how he wanted to go about that. And my job in our relationship is to really guide and support and facilitate that. And you're not quite sure how you're going to react, particularly when it plays out in such a public space like that on such a big stage, and it's a win as well. But for me, it wasn't so much relief, but just like, holy crap, he did it. He got up and he executed and he did what no one thought he was ever going to do in his career, which was get close to fulfilling his potential. And again, for him to do that on that stage, like it was awesome. Like I was looking straight at him from sort of 50 meters away, and he got up on the lane rope and thumped his chest and pointed straight back at me. And I was like doing the same thing, pointing back at him, which is pretty out of character for us. We're not real. It was funny. You'd kind of expect the more alpha moments to happen before the race, but here we were, very sentimental and emotional before an outcome. And then after it, it was just like, king of the jungle, dude, let's go. So it was, it's hard to describe, but there's a deep, deep level of satisfaction, but just so much pride in Cam, for him to be able to show the world what he was capable of doing in that moment. As I said, when many people thought that his opportunity to do that was well and truly past.
Well, the pride here in Wilmington, North Carolina was thick. I started crying. It was beautiful. And the word I think that might come to mind, and maybe you can elaborate maybe, is vindication, because what you guys did was very, you kind of took a risky path to this place. And it's not a path that people have taken before, as I understand. Can you first speak to the difference in approach you took to getting him to be the fastest in the world, as opposed to how others were going about it?
Yeah, for sure. And I won't go into the highly technical or nitty gritty of this too much, in this platform. But ultimately, Cam has been one of the fastest swimmers in the world for the better part of the last 12 years. You know, he qualified for his first Olympics in 2012 as an 18-year-old, I believe. By 2016, he went into Rio as the favorite for the 100 freestyle and definitely a medal chance in the 50 freestyle. He's still the fifth or sixth fastest all-time 100 freestyler from that period of his career. Had always taken pretty traditional approaches to his training, as part of bigger programs, very hierarchical, I guess, in the sense of the coach athlete dynamic that exists in swimming, very coach driven. The athlete basically just jumps in, does what coach says. There's not a whole lot of space. I don't want to speak for every program, but there's not usually a whole lot of space for collaboration and input from the athlete. And Cam's an incredibly, incredibly intelligent guy with, I can't even sum up kind of how brilliant his swimming mind is and really just his general mind in the, in the science and math world as well. So he's always been a deep thinker about his swimming, always had some ideas of his own. And after 2021, he was pretty much done with the sport, decided to walk away and had a year of kind of self-discovery, rebuild his body, and was kind of preparing for life after swimming. And he found his way back into the pool post-COVID, did a 50 freestyle for a bit of fun and was far, like almost quicker than he was in Tokyo, I think, after like a year off. And that sparked him to map out a different way of doing things with that really incorporated the majority of his own ideas and his own thoughts. And he was looking for a space where he could experiment and put those ideas into play, but he still needed a coach and somebody to work with in a variety of different capacities. Some of it's from programming guidance and advice. Some of it's just general input from me into which direction he should be going and what we think will work and won't work based on previous experiences. Part of it was just having, like a mindset coach there to be able to, help him navigate through all the things that come along with this mentally as well. And part of that program for Cam was, as I said, like really taking a very different approach than what traditional swimmers had done in the past, leaning heavily into the world of track and field, strength and conditioning, track cycling, like borrowing as much as possible to kind of shape this new approach. And as I said, I don't really do it justice when I put it into my words compared to his, but long story short, we connected a couple of years ago. We weren't really sure where it was going to go or what it would look like. And it just, we instantly hit it off, which was obviously important. Like we had a lot of common philosophies and values. Part of that was just that willingness to do something different, give it a red hot crack. And if it didn't work out, it didn't work out. Like simple as that. No one's dead. We're not here trying to cure cancer. We're just seeing if we can swim a little bit quicker. And I think with that at the heart of what we were doing, hey, let's just see how fast you can go and have some fun doing it and see if we can work together and find a different way of doing things. But one of the things I'd said to Cam from the beginning was my biggest goal for him was, regardless of whether he swam for 3 weeks or another 3 years, that where his relationship was with the sport after the Tokyo Olympics was pretty much at an all-time low. And to me, it was really sad to see someone that's poured 20 plus years into their craft and their passion to be so kind of over it. So a goal of mine was to just make sure that whenever Cam pulls up stumps and he's done, that his relationship with the sport is stronger than ever and he can move on for the rest of his life knowing that he did everything that he could to give himself the best possible chance to be as good as he could be. And with this, when you start with those two goals, enjoy it and try to be as fast as you can. Like there's no bad outcome.
Yeah. And I find that so intriguing because a lot of people, when they think of a coach, they're thinking of a taskmaster who's on your back, who's maybe yelling at you. There's lots of different styles, but you're representation of the relationship is very much one of a symbiosis. You guys are working together. He can tell you maybe he doesn't want to do it, and you're not going to be like, no, you better do it. And there's a lot of listening going on. Does a relationship like that in your mind build the swimmer up to have that better relationship with swimming? Because I do hear so much about these college athletes, and you were one here in Wilmington, that just after the season's over, maybe their senior year, they don't swim again ever, maybe. And they're just over the situation. And I think that's so tragic, because swimming's something you can take into your end of days. Could you speak on that?
Yeah, for sure. There's, like anything, there's so many different approaches. I think as a coach, you got to recognize the approach that's going to work best for the athlete that you're working with. So you got to wear many different hats when you're coaching. So, you know, you might have 20 athletes in front of you. It's just like a classroom teacher. You're going to have 20. It's difficult, because if you've got 20 athletes in front of you, or 20 students in front of you, there's likely going to be 20 different learning styles in front of you as well, and 20 different approaches that they're going to respond to. And to try to tap into all of them is very difficult and almost an impossible task. But in saying that, trying to find ways, unique ways to reach individuals within large groups is part of your job as a coach or a teacher or somebody that influences, that's trying to influence learning and growth. So I think when you bring it back to me and Cam, it's obviously one-on-one. It's very, very individualized. So part of my job was to recognize the type of person that Cam is. And I think you know this as well with your background. When you find people that can connect with you, understand who you are, and figure out how to bring, you know, your strengths to the forefront, then anything's possible. And on the flip side, if you're around people that are in positions of influence that don't have the capacity to do that, it can be incredibly disheartening and make it almost impossible for you to reach your potential. So there are a lot of athletes out there. I mean, I've got plenty of my swimmers in, a lot of the swimmers in my program, particularly the younger athletes, like, they're happy to walk in the door. They respect you as a coach. They respect you as a person and a role model. And if you tell them to jump, you know, this high, they'll try to jump higher, just because of that's where they're at and that's how they're conditioned. And yeah, I'm totally okay with that as well. Certainly don't take advantage of that, and still try to give them space or remind them, if you see a different way of doing things or if you've got ideas of your own, let's have an open conversation. You're not going to be threatening me or my knowledge base. I want to encourage you guys to be critical thinkers and question in appropriate way, like learn how to question the process. These swimmers, and they're going to have to prepare for life outside of the pool at some point. They're going to have to navigate their way through relationships. They're going to have to navigate their way through employment situations with bosses and stuff like that. So, you know, try to give them some of those tools to be able to have more challenging conversations and tricky situations is really important to me. And again, bring that back to Cam. That was some of the challenges he had as a swimmer over his career, that he had huge ideas of his own. And he wasn't necessarily seeking all the time to be the captain of the ship, so to speak, but just to even be heard and be listened to and be acknowledged is a really important part of that. And to go back to what we were saying before, you know, with Cam, yeah, I mean, just to see him thrive and flourish in this environment, and again, feel as though he's starting to get close to be able to reach his potential as an athlete when that may not have happened, is just something I'm incredibly fortunate to be a part of and be able to play a small role in.
So sick, man. My next question here goes down to nature versus nurture. You've seen thousands of kids through your time as a coach over the last 20 years. And I'm sure each one of those kids had dreams of a gold medal. You've now, one of your swimmers has gotten the gold medal. How much of the process to getting to the top is the natural ability and the work that goes into getting there? Or is it a little bit of both? Or what's your thought process? And a follow-up on that, how do you as the coach spot that guy in the pool and say, now that's something special?
Yeah, that's a good question. Like, I don't think, you know, I certainly don't think people are born and just destined to be Olympic champions or reach the top of their craft. I mean, so much goes into it. And there's so much literature out there as well, you know, like some of the, you know, the classic known books, like your 10,000 hours concepts, you know, your outliers, research. I mean, there's so many different ways to look at it. It's definitely a combination of both. For some, it might be heavily more weighed towards nature. For some others, towards nurture. But to separate the two is almost impossible. One thing I've definitely learned over time is, you know, talent identification, which is essentially what you're talking about right now, I guess, is incredibly difficult. Like a story that I always refer back to when we talk about talent ID with younger athletes is, take the NFL, right? It's one of the world's, if not the world's biggest sporting organization or industry, like just billions and billions and billions of dollars pumped into the NFL. And a huge part of the NFL is your ability to get things right with draft picks and be able to talent ID. And I always laugh because the NFL, every team gets that wrong pretty much every single year. They've got all the data, all the metrics, they've got everything you could possibly have. And the greatest NFL player of all time was barely even drafted. So if the NFL can't get it right, the chances of me being able to sit there and predict what a 12, 13 or 14 year old is going to look like at 18, 19, 20 is impossible. And I really don't try to do that. What I really try to do with the athletes in front of me that come through our door is, at an individual level, I try to check in with them maybe every 3 to 6 months and say, why are you walking through the door? What are you trying to get out of this? And then really just try to shape the experience for them to match what their goals are at that point in time, because you just don't know where people are going to end up. And I think the minute that you start going too hard down, like, hey, this kid's got something, he's special, I'm going to put him on a different trajectory, I think that makes it, A, really hard for those kids at times, puts a lot of pressure on them subconsciously. And I think it's kind of an unreal expectation on yourself as a coach that, oh, I see this talent, if they don't win a gold medal, then I haven't done my job as well. So, I think just recognizing where people are at different points in time, there's so much growth, maturation. You've got early maturers, late maturers. You've got, you know, people that come to the sport late. You've got those that are overexposed to the sport and specialize really early. And all those things really, like, a big part of my job is, because I can't predict what the future is going to look like at 11, 12, 13 for a kid, a big part of me is knowing that peak performance is probably not going to take place to 21, 22, 23, 24, 30 with Cam, you know, is how do I keep them in the sport so that if it is something that they want to pursue when they're getting closer to being at their physical peak, that they're still in that position and not burnt out or hating it. So I don't know if that really answers your question, but it's that's my take on it.
It was beautiful, Tim. Absolutely beautiful. And hold on 1 second. I had some knocking at the door. Hold on.
No dramas. You're good.
Okay, they've left. Yeah, Cornelia's out of town, and it's like 2 o'clock here, so they're like all over. It's a miracle that we're doing this. But let's get back to it. Dude, like, we first met in 2001 at Newcastle. I didn't know anybody. We ran into each other on campus, struck it up. Our love for surfing got us hanging out, the whole experience. I visited your family, a beautiful town down on the South Coast, Nara. And like, you didn't swim then. Like, as an athlete swims, you know, like, you swam, you surfed, like, you had love for the water, but like, swimming wasn't at the top of your priority list. And we said our goodbyes. We said we'll keep in touch. And literally, like, 2 years later, you show up at my home university, the University of Wilmington in North Carolina, a jacked, like, collegiate swimmer. And I'm like, dude, what happened? And you go on to say, oh, I had a back injury, and all of a sudden I was getting faster and faster. And like, first of all, Like, that blew my mind, bro. And you show up here and you lay your mark. You crush it. I went to your meets. I will never forget the meet at William and Mary. You walked out to Laffy Taffy, and I couldn't resist dancing in the crowd. Like, it, like, your story is incredible. So let's go back to where we said our goodbyes. Like, how did you get back into that pool, or just into the pool period? And because it's so inspirational.
Yeah, appreciate it. It's this will be fun to go down memory lane a little bit and try to put some of this into context, I guess, because, you know, I grew up on the south coast of New South Wales. You've been to my home. You know, mum and dad are still in the same place. Beautiful part of the world, national parks, beaches everywhere, like, phenomenal. A lot of your listeners, I'm sure, are surfers and watermen. You know, for me, being in the water was just, that was an everyday occurrence for us. And learning to swim at a young age was obviously super important as part of that lifestyle. I was a really good sort of 8, 9, 10-year-old swimmer at a really high level. And for us, like, for me, it wasn't my number one passion. And I was a really late developer. Like, I didn't go through puberty till like 16 or 17. So as I got to 11, 12, 13, I started seeing these guys shoot up and just get so much faster. I just kind of thought that I was no good. You can't appreciate when you're a kid how important physical maturation is in improvement, particularly for the males, you know. So I just figured swimming wasn't for me, and really threw myself into my surfing. And, you know, my mates from high school, my brother Pat, who still surfs almost every day when he gets a chance to, we would just spend our weekends just going up and down the coast trying to find waves. So that's kind of pretext to how we ended up getting together. I left the South Coast in 2001 for uni in Newcastle. And at that point, I still had in the back of my mind, I'd gone through puberty, I'd grown a little bit, I'd done a couple of school swimming carnivals and showed like massive improvements. So I hadn't completely let go of that little piece of my identity that did identify as a swimmer. But it was kind of hard to figure out, like, how was I going to put that into play? And when I still had so many other passions and interests. And yeah, I had a few back injuries and some subluxations and, you know, some disc trouble. And I was in a fair bit of discomfort. I was feeling a little unfit, a little unhealthy. I wasn't able to surf for a period there, and just got back into the pool and sort of started off using it for some fitness and just started kind of escalating from there. Met some other guys that trained in the program that were doing, you know, surf lifesaving, which I know you're a huge part of now. And started training with them, met some of the pool swimmers, and kind of at the same time when we met, you know, like, we hit it off straight away. Like, you're this surfer dude from the East Coast of the United States. And we're, you know, it was like something out of, I can't remember that movie we used to watch. I think it was like Fast Times at Ridgemont High. We're like, this is Spicoli right here. This is the dude, you know? So we'd have a lot of fun with that. And a huge, like, I took immense amount of pride in being able to show you the South Coast of New South Wales and get you out of Newcastle, which is obviously a great town as well. But I'm like, mate, I know you love it here. And I know this is like, you feel like you've got waves on tap and like you're in Disneyland here, but wait till you see the South Coast. So we took some midnight trips down there and drove that old red car with wheels flying off it and boards flying off the roof and God knows what else. And those were like some of my fondest memories, you know, going down to potholes and staying in the cabins there with you and a few of my high school mates. And I mean, just endless stories of surf trips, and which is so far removed from the structured world of what my swimming life became very soon after you left town. But the catalyst for me, I at the time after meeting you, I wanted to go. I'd always had a strong affinity with the United States. I'd always followed US sports, and for whatever reason, I'd always had a desire to get over to the US and spend some time there. So for me, my pathway when we met was, I'll do a semester abroad and I'll start looking into those. But as swimming progressed a little bit, I met a couple of guys that were on swimming scholarships in the US, and I started looking into that a little bit more. And it just so happened UNC Wilmington had a really good swim program that was like perfect for the level that I was at and that I was trying to aspire to be at. Mid-major school on the East Coast of the US, with a lifestyle and a culture that's pretty similar to Newcastle, strong surf culture, strong water culture, pretty laid back people. Like it was a no brainer for me. I reached out to the head coach, Coach Allen, who had a huge influence on me and my ability to be able to get over to the US. And it just always felt like it was just going to be. So I realized what I would have to do to put myself in a situation to get onto that team and to be able to get a little bit of financial assistance as well. And I dropped out of uni in Newcastle and just trained for 2 years and just poured everything I could into it. And it's incredible what you can get done with that mindset. That's for sure. Because by the time I walked, I think I probably would have messed up. I don't know how we would have contacted each other back then. It definitely wasn't through cell phones. I know that. I don't know, maybe email or Facebook, AIM Messenger or something.
You emailed me because we didn't have Facebook yet. Yeah.
No. So I was like, dude, I'm in. I'm coming to UNC Wilmington. And, it always felt like home, like really quickly when I got there. It was everything that you'd described. It had your recommendation. It had your validation. So that was good enough for me anyway, I think. So, it was incredible. And being able to get there, had a great experience. And, I don't think UNC Wilmington, I don't think it comes onto my radar. Definitely not if it wasn't for you and how I managed to see a pathway to not just do a semester abroad there, but basically create a life there for a short period of time was pretty cool and something that I am proud of looking back on.
And you went in there, your first real coach, I guess, was Dave Allen, right? Like you were kind of coaching yourself. Then you came to UNCW with your times. How did that whole relationship build? And can you say a word a little bit about his coaching style?
Yeah, Coach Allen had a huge influence on me. I mean, the program that I'd swum for in Newcastle, I had a coach who was, so supportive of me, was a mentor to me, was like, almost like a dad away from home for me. And to come over to the other side of the world, and Coach Allen kind of filled that figure right there. I mean, Coach Allen was very direct. He just delivered the workout, here's what needs to be done and go for it. But because you respect the man and that's delivering that, you're happy to jump in and do it without asking too many questions. So I the opportunity that Coach Allen gave me, and even through my first year not being able to come home for Christmas breaks and stuff like that, I stayed in Wilmington after classes were done for, I think there was a 2 week period where it was just me and Coach Allen doing one-on-ones, like crazy, like 15 300s in the morning and then, like 2200s at night. It's just Coach Allen delivering them to me. And he could be pretty tough at times. I remember one night, I think I got to the seventh 300. He's like, you're not holding a good enough pace. You're going to start again. And I'm like, dude, I'm the only one here right now. I'm giving you everything. But he just always held you to a really high standard. So I appreciate that. I think that was my first Christmas. I actually came up and spent that with you and your family off the back of that couple of weeks of training. I guess like for me, the opportunities that he gave me, but then the relationships that we built through that will be something I'll always be grateful for. And, Coach Allen's now since passed. And, when you have moments of success, you kind of always naturally just think back to a few people that have impacted those. And, Coach Allen's definitely somebody that I don't go too many weeks or months without thinking about the impact that he had on my life and where I've gone to today, for sure.
And what were your strokes at that time?
Primarily freestyle. Like, I came from a really blue collar program where we just grinded our yardage and it was like the harder you work, like more pain, more gain. And I embraced that because I got good off that real quick. That was my pathway to getting to the US was this concentrated period of 2 years where I just pumped as much volume into me as I possibly could. And, I benefited from that in the short term. It's not a hugely, it's probably not the best. It's not sustainable for long periods of time, the way that I went about that in that short block, but it certainly was enough to jumpstart me and get me to the level that I needed to be at. So yeah, primarily freestyle was probably more like 200 and 500 when I was in college. It wasn't my senior year. I only had 2 years of eligibility. So my second year happened to be Todd DeSorbo's first year of college coaching. Todd, now he was on the US staff for the Olympics. He was women's head coach for swimming. So that was, again, super cool to reconnect with him, but over in Paris. But his first year, he came in with a lot of outside the box thinking, a lot of different ways of doing things, a lot more sprint focused, a lot more strength and power focused. Here I was, somebody that was just obsessed with grinding out as many laps as possible. And I probably struggled a little bit to see the merit in the way and the beauty in what Todd was doing that first year. And I, looking back on it, I wish I had have realized that at the time, because I might have been able to do a year with Todd and maybe explore the 200 and down, which is where I probably would have been a little bit better suited. But yeah, primarily freestyle at that point. And then with only 2 years of eligibility, I was my college career at Wilmington only lasted 2 years. You know, I was halfway through a degree that I sort of transferred over a little bit from Australia. So, you know, I was done college swimming in 2 years and my degree at Wilmington in 3 years. So it was a bit of a flash in the pan, really, when I look back on it.
And that degree was in exercise science, right?
Yeah, so I started out when we met in Newcastle, and you know, I was heavily influenced by my parents growing up and the impact, the work that they did in the community. So my initial passion was a social work degree, and that's what I started in Newcastle. But by the time I'd gotten into the swimming and realized I was going to be transferring over, doing a social work degree in the US was never going to be compatible with what it is back in Australia. And I was never going to be able to do sort of the clinical hours and stuff that would be involved with that while swimming as well. So yeah, just naturally ended up into an exercise phys degree. Shout out to my academic advisor and mentor, Christian Barnes, who is an Aussie guy. He was a professor at UNC Wilmington. Family is in North Carolina, married an American woman, and he's got a beautiful family over there as well. So he was, again, incredibly influential in me taking that track and figuring out how to make all of my past credits kind of merge into this new degree. And yeah, like Barnsley, yeah, he's a good Aquaman as well, great surfer. We played a lot of golf together. I mean, I had a really good Aussie family there in Wilmington as well. I think there were about 15 or 20 of us. Through those years. So yeah.
Epic. And that single change there sent you on the way to your first coaching job right out of UNCW. You went to Villanova, right?
Yeah, so at the end of graduation was like I think May in 2008, and I was trying to figure out what I was going to do coming back to Australia. You know, like I had this degree, I was starting to get really interested in looking into the strength and conditioning field, maybe trying to work my way up, you know, to work in high performance sports. Maybe rugby league is something I was really passionate about. So trying to figure out what would be a pathway for me to be able to do S&C at a pretty high level. And at the same time, Todd's brother-in-law, Rick Simpson, he's the head coach at Villanova. He's still up there now. Was looking for an assistant coach. I remember Todd saying to me, "Yo, man, what do you think about Villanova?" And I was like, "Yeah, I could go to Nashville." And he's like, "No, fool." He's like, "Villanova's in Philadelphia." And I was like, "Oh, right. Okay." I was thinking of Vanderbilt. Like, I had no idea. And yeah, I flew up there, took an interview with Rick, and we hit it off immediately. He had an idea of what he wanted to do with the program, wanted to recruit some international athletes in there, which I felt like even without any college coaching experience, I definitely felt like I could recruit well straight off the bat. And yeah, moved up there and spent 4 years in Philly, which was another, you know, that's just in another box, like a different part of my life. And I've got just some of my best friends that I'm still really close with today. I've been in a couple of weddings of those guys over the years, and they remain, you know, a couple of my best mates to this day as well. So I've got my 4 years in Philly is very, like, very, very close to my heart, those 4 years. People give Philly a bad rap, man. I absolutely loved my time up there. I think you were like, "Dude, what are you doing? You're like so far from the coast. Like,
Well,
there's no surf. This
that you
place
know,
sucks."
yeah, you do remember me saying that because I am so hyper beach, right? You know this about me, but like your pathway is so serendipitous, and You then transferred to Perth. Is that you? Yep. Then you went to Notre Dame as the head coach. And what was that like going, you know, you were in America for so long, then you went back to Australia, but the other side of the country, which is its own culture, basically. Can you speak to that transfer and then your need then to get back to America and where that lived in you?
Yeah, I got to a point probably in my fourth year at Villanova. For some reason, I got real homesick, and I missed Australia. I missed family. I don't know what it was actually. I can't really recall it, but it was just something, a yearning in me to get back home. And a position came up in Perth, and I'd never even been to Perth before. I mean, this is pretty typical of the moves that I've made. Just move somewhere you've never even been. Don't even go and scout it. Just go. And I was just so excited to have a coaching opportunity back home in Australia that I jumped at it. And I got out to Perth, and Perth's an incredible place, like just an amazing part of the world. Like it's beautiful. It's isolated. You've got, you know, Margaret River in that area, a few hours down south. You can really venture up into the north and take some amazing trips. But for me, I got out there and I was like, oh, wait, my family's still a 6-hour flight away. I don't know anybody here. You know, I might as well be in Philly right now. Like I felt real isolated out there. And after a couple of years, the opportunity came to go back to the US, to the University of Notre Dame. And funnily enough, when I was in Perth, I was really missing probably the college scene and the US swim scene a lot. And I would have gone back to Sydney if opportunities came up on the East Coast, but at that time, there weren't any available, and I felt as though to continue to build my career, it was probably better to get back over to the US at a great institution like Notre Dame. And, you know, so I kind of jumped at that and, again, went to a place I'd never been to before, South Bend, Indiana. Not sure I'll ever move back to the Midwest again at any point soon, but it was an awesome uni. And it's funny how, like, I just remember all these stories, like, interweaving together with conversations we would have in the background, because you're like, dude, that was my dream school. Like, oh, I thought I was going to be the quarterback for Notre Dame. This is so sick, you know, like touchdown Jesus. And I'm like, I don't even know about this stuff.
Yeah. Yeah, dude.
I don't know if you remember that, but I remember.
I do. Because in middle school, you know, I wanted to be a gridiron, as you all call it, football player.
Mm-hmm.
And I was too small. And no one was like, hey, Sean, this isn't the sport for you. So I just was third string quarterback, just getting ripped to pieces at practice. And I didn't quit until my senior year. But before that, I would wear Notre Dame jackets because Rudy was my favorite movie. And I was like, I'm going to be like Rudy. But yeah, shouts out to those former dreams. But yeah, so you then do go back to Australia, and you go down this line of like just getting in with the best of the best. I remember you were telling me a couple months ago, like some of the guys that I follow in the surf lifesaving world have been underneath you as your athletes. Can you speak to that culture, surf lifesaving in particular, and how it relates to the swimming world and kind of your perspective on it?
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, well, you know, a big part of the move back to Australia from Notre Dame was family driven. At that stage, my now wife Kristen and I were very serious and looking to start a family. And part of our journey to start a family was we quickly realized it was going to be through IVF, and it was just a big part of it was our healthcare system and affordability and accessibility in Australia. It was just incredible. So for us, it was a no-brainer to try to get back to the east coast of Australia and put ourselves in a position where we could hopefully have a family one day and build a life together. So we arrived on the northern beaches in Sydney, a place I'd been to, but definitely not a place I'd lived before. But it's the northern beaches of Sydney is just magical. I mean, again, you know, you couldn't imagine a city the size of Sydney just having incredible coastlines and great surf. I mean, probably comparable to like a San Diego or something like that, I guess, in reflection. But the surf lifesaving culture is a huge part of Australian history. It's, you know, I mean, it is it's visible on every single beach. Obviously, they're patrolling the beaches, they're saving lives, they're looking after people, but they've also got the competitive side of things. You know, the surf races, the ski races, the board races, the Ironman, which is a combination of all of them, stuff that you guys are involved with over there on the East Coast as well. But when I got to the northern beaches in Warringah, and the program was pretty much not in existence. I had to really build it up. And a big part of our clientele at that stage were competitive surf lifesavers. So I really embraced that surf culture, was able to build a program around them. And the crossover, like for those guys, they would swim every morning, five mornings a week, and then they'd be training on the beach in the afternoon. So swimming was still such a core part of their sort of competitive processes. So I got to know a lot of those families and athletes really well. And probably after about a year of just spending time building the program, you know, just sort of through word of mouth that there was a different option for the guys that were training down there, that might be suitable for them, as they, you know, my experience and my expertise started to get out there a little bit. One of the guys who I chatted on the phone with him for like 2 hours last week, Kendrick Louie, who I'm actually going to Sydney this weekend. I'll get to catch up with Kenj, and he and I are incredibly close. He's a professional surf lifesaver. He came over to me, I think, in 2017 or maybe at the end of 2016. And he went on a little bit of a run through there and kind of rejuvenated his career.
I watched all of his videos.
I know you're a massive fan. I know that.
Tell him I said hello.
I will. Absolutely. But, you know, Kenj was like, what I'm doing now with Cam, there is a lot of things that took place for me to develop that skill set and that understanding of an older athlete and the capacity to accept other ideas into my coaching philosophy and not be threatened by that. And Kenj was an example of that. He was very, very professional, had a clear idea of what he needed to do and how he needed to go about it. And I would lean on Kenj. Like, I didn't know a whole lot about surf lifesaving. So I'd say, like, I'm thinking this, but would this work? And he'd be like, nah, absolutely not. This is probably the best way to go about it. But like, I want your DNA on it. Like, how do we get your imprint on this now that you're getting a better understanding of what our needs are? And, you know, like, Kenj and I worked really well together, but very collaborative and huge amount of respect for each other and trust in each other. And like we were talking about before, that seemed to bring out the best in Kenj for that period of his career, for sure. So something I'm real proud of. And again, just embracing that surf life-saving community and culture and what they do bring to a program, those athletes, they bring an incredible work ethic. Like, they'll walk through the door and just grind. Like, again, like I was saying, my swimming journey when I was in Newcastle, like, it's they want it as hard as possible. You spend more time telling them that it doesn't have to be like this insane grind where your heart rate needs to be at 180 the entire time. Like, you're actually frying yourself and cooking yourself. So trying to educate them around training methods at times was challenging but real fun. And as I said, like, my career in Sydney for that 4 year period before we moved to Brisbane was like, we wouldn't have had the success we had without embracing the surf life-saving culture, bringing them into the program. But those guys would also race distance events for us in the pool as well. So many of my first junior national medalists were 14 and 15-year-old kids that weren't full-time swimmers, but they're just so fit and so robust and so fearless. They'd come to nationals and jump in and just like rip epic 800s and 1500s, and just they were so tough. And we were able to build a bit of a culture around that as well. So, like, very grateful for those kids. It's awesome to see them doing really well these days. Like, the Morris brothers are three boys that I think would still be on sort of that pro circuit back here, and the Doyle girls are two families that come to mind. So, you know, if you've got any listeners out there in that space, yeah, the Morris boys and the Doyle girls are still doing real good stuff as well.
And as a coach, we were just talking about the 50. We're now talking about the 1500, two opposite things. How do you, what's your belief on how to approach them from a pool volume perspective?
Yeah, that's a good one to bring up. I mean, like, a lot of people don't realize this, but you know, in 2016, I had an athlete with me for a couple of years, Taewon Park, a Korean swimmer. And Taewon at 18, he won the 400 freestyle in 2008 in Beijing. So he was a gold medalist in the 400. His career took a number of different turns and paths, and just kind of by chance, he ended up with me in Sydney in 2016 and prepared him a little bit before the Rio Olympics. Things didn't go great, and I thought I'd never see him again, but he came back and, you know, we sat down and planned out what we thought the next year or two would look like. And at the end of 2016, we went to the Short Course World Championships in Windsor, Canada. And Park won the 1500, won the 400, won the 200, and just went on this really good run in those events. So, like, obviously complete opposite ends of the spectrum when you're looking at the 50 compared to a 1500. But, like, ultimately you've got to look at the athlete that's in front of you, look at their training history, see what their characteristics are, see the type of work that they like to do. Like Park still wanted to train at 4:30 in the morning to give him as much space between his 5 o'clock session at night. He still felt like he needed a certain amount of volume. And then obviously, again, I'd sprinkle my DNA into that and sort of come up with a framework that I thought would help him be successful. So, you know, there's certain non-negotiables that you've kind of just got to do. Like if you're going to be a 50 swimmer, you've got to be technically excellent. You've got to be really strong. You've got to be explosive, and you've got to be focused on strength and speed and power. Whereas if you're a 1500 swimmer, you've got to have, certainly at the elite level, like you've got to have phenomenal technique as well. But, you know, you've got to have a really well-developed and well-refined aerobic capacity and endurance quality. So I think sometimes as a coach, people, when you're having like a lot of success in one domain, like me and the rest of the program are having in shorter events at the moment, they kind of forget that almost all coaches out there have got experience across a wide range of events and distances. It's just what you've got to do as a coach is be like, if I have kids walk through the door and I've had successes coaching 1500s and 800s, that I don't just come in and coach everyone like that, you know. And you've got to be adaptable and flexible and sort of be pretty skilled in a variety of different areas of program delivery. And that's where people come unstuck is, well, I'm a distance coach, and regardless of who walks through my door, we're just doing distance work. Or I'm a sprint coach, and even if I have somebody that comes in with, you know, an endurance gene that's only in 5% of the population, too bad, we're doing sprint work. Like, it's probably not going to work out, you know.
How's your personal relationship with your swimming right now?
Me personally? Yeah, that's a good question. Like, I love swimming, no doubt. I think because of my journey, and I was never burned out from swimming. I only ever swam because I wanted to. So I was never forced to do it, which is why it was easy for me to walk away from it during my age group years. And then it was certainly easy for me to come back to it in my college years when I really had a clearly defined goal. I think for me, I would love to still swim every single day. But being a coach and being at the pool sort of 40, 50 hours a week, it's staying there for an extra hour and a half or 2 hours to bang out some laps is just something that I can't do mentally. But, you know, if I had a, you know, quote unquote regular job or, you know, was completely out of the swimming world, like let's say I worked in the city in a 9 to 5, I'd be swimming 5 a.m. till 7 a.m. every single morning. I'm certain of that. Absolutely certain of it. But I kind of just, I guess my swimming fix, just takes place through other people at the moment.
So what are you doing physically for yourself?
At the moment, like, to be honest, my weeks are like, I'm on pool deck 20 to 30 hours a week. So I'm on my feet. Like I'm out there getting 10, 12, 14,000 steps every single day, just coaching. I've got two boys under the age of 4. So I've got a 4.5-year-old and a 2-year-old. I mean, I'm on my feet and moving all day. I'm pretty conscious of how I, you know, of how I eat. My wife's an incredible cook. We don't eat out. You know, everything's home cooked. I think basically, just like to answer your question, I'm not super structured. I don't have like a workout routine or a 1 hour a day that I devote to that, but I'm super active. You know, I'm up at 3:30, 4 o'clock every single day. You know, constantly moving, that's kind of my work kind of takes care of a lot of that, I think.
Now, a little bit of a personal question that from my, you know, we're both, I'm 43. I think you're 40 now, right?
41, I think.
41. Yeah.
Yeah, 41. Yeah. Yeah.
And you're an exercise scientist. You see the world, the physical world. So are we on decline right now, or is there room for improvement, or yours maybe fastest days behind us? Like, what's your standpoint on aging and longevity in the water?
I mean, I think, you know, we could go in so many different directions with this. I read a book a couple of years ago called Lifespan. So if any of your listeners out there want to start reading a little bit about the aging process and some of the evidence out there that you can kind of start reversing your age process, Lifespan is an incredible book. An Australian scientist who did most of his studies up in, I think it was at, might not have been Harvard, but in the Boston area, but incredible, like talking about, again, small measures that you can make at our age to start, like, you know, at least biologically becoming younger. And, you know, they've done so many different studies where they are able to almost reverse that age process. So I think, you know, there's definitely advancements being made in those areas. I think obviously there's some people starting to go down more the performance enhancing routes to be able to stay youthful and live longer, healthier lives. There's going to be a lot of advancement in that in the next sort of decade, I think. But for me, like, obviously there's a point in time where, you know, there is a deterioration of your body, but a big part of that through exercise, and also through just mental health as well, which is obviously so closely related, I think you can definitely delay that process. And I think that should be something even I need, like just talking about this and you challenging me to have an opinion on it is actually really helpful, because it's something that I need to put more thought into on a more regular basis. What are the little things we can just do on a day-to-day basis just to delay that deterioration? And that's all we're looking for, right? And there's plenty of things out of our control as well. I mean, you know, there's a lot of really terrible, unfortunate conditions that people get that aren't related to lifestyle, that are just genetic, and, you know, which is really sad. But by and large, there are many things in our control. And I think trying to take control of those and hopefully extending your life for, you know, another 5, 10, 15 years, and quality life as well. Like, I think I'd speak for everyone here that's listening. There's a big difference between living to 80 and having 75 years of those where you're almost, you're functioning close to your best, as opposed to living to 90, where the last 20 of those, you just, you're nowhere near your best, and it's really the quality of life is low. So I think thinking about it in those contexts is really helpful as well.
And do you think that I've heard before that activity is almost more important than the food? You know, the food is great, but a lot of people are hung up on like the food they're eating, and then they don't train, they don't do any activity. Would you say that activity is king, is paramount, and food, yes, is important, but secondary?
Yeah, I'm not 100% sure. I reckon, again, that they're both probably closely linked in different ways. I think, you know, we all do have a genetic predisposition to certain foods and certain diets that can definitely enhance our quality of life and longevity. There's no question about that. But I think it's tried and tested that those that continue to move, you know, like we talked about that with swimming. I mean, my old man still swims every single morning, you know, a couple of K. You go down to any beach in Sydney or here in Australia, there are people in their 60s and 70s out there doing ocean swims and in the rock pools, and they're walking, they're cycling. I mean, the lifestyle down here and the value that's placed on just constant movement and just general exercise is huge. It's something that I didn't realize that was relatively unique to us, to other parts of the world, I think. But yeah, I think the constant movement and, you know, obviously the mental, like mental stimulation is such a huge part of, you know, trying to delay that aging process as well. That's why we see so many people, and like particularly in the coaching field that I'm involved in now, like one of the most successful coaches of all time, Eddie Reese, like at the University of Texas, like he's finally retired this year, but people thought he was going to retire 20 years ago. But you could tell that staying on deck, staying around the college athletes, being involved in that community would have had a huge impact on his health as well. So I think the mental side of things and that space is probably still underexplored a little bit, but I don't think you can discount that being part of a community, something greater than yourself, and constantly being challenged to tap into that brain muscle, I think goes a long way for longevity and quality of life as well.
Well, shouts out to your dad, Tony Lane. I remember vividly waking up on your floor one morning. I think we had a lot of Tui's new the night before, and he Definitely. Halfway jokingly goes, "All right, guys, come on, we're going to do a 10K race." And I popped up and I was like, "Let's go." And he was not expecting that. And I hadn't run competitively since the end of high school. You know, the senior year, I didn't do football. I quit that. And I had a pretty successful senior year running, and I hadn't really run since then. And that day kind of kicked off the rest of my life as an athlete who liked competing, getting on the starting line. And I think I did pretty well that race. I don't know. I think I might've won it, but I attribute your
sounds like you did.
I will go with it. I attribute your dad in that halfway joke to like really like getting into my later life of where I am today. So I thank you and your family for that. Do you remember
that day.
Yeah.
Yeah, 100%. Like we're down on a surf trip, and yeah, we'd done God knows what the night before, and Dad comes down, you're like, "Hey, Tony, where are you going?" He's like, "Oh, I've got this cross-country race out in the bush." And you're just like, "I'm going." I'm like, "Are you out of your mind?" Like, he's like, "Come on, man." I'm like, "No chance. There is no chance I'm going cross-country running right now."
Yeah.
And I think my dad was like, "Who is this dude? Like, what the hell?" And came back. I remember saying to Dad out the front of the house, I was like, "How'd he go?" He's like, "That guy was like a hare. He just took off. No one could catch him." I was like, "His lungs must be burning." That's all.
Dude, it was beautiful. It was up the hills. And I think we went to one of those things the night before. You got the little clubs with the where they serve the beer. It's not a bar, but it's a it was at the golf course.
The golf club. Yeah.
The golf club.
But not
yeah.
like a but not like a fancy country club.
No. And I remember the old men next to me. I was like, "Yeah, I want to move to Australia and get my citizenship." And they're like, "Why don't you just come over on a boat?" Remember that?
that's funny.
Good stuff.
Cool stuff.
Bro, well, I know you have a hard stop. Is that right? Where are we here? It's
How are we
3:07.
Looking?
It's 3:07. Okay. You tell me. Yeah.
Yeah, another 10 minutes. We're good.
Okay. All right. I wanna get back to this word I heard on the previous podcast. I got a shout out that you did a couple days ago with Brett Hawk. Is that how I pronounce his name?
Yep.
Yeah. He has an awesome podcast. I just learned about it because you were on it. But I invite listeners to check that one out because Tim goes on there with Cam and really breaks down the relationship they have. But you guys are talking about neural overload, and I want to know more about that and neural fatigue. Tell me about this.
Yeah, so I mean, again, it's not a new concept. It's certainly something that exists, and it's probably just more in the swimming world starting to pay attention to it a little bit. And just that concept of when you go absolutely max, whether you're going for one rep max in the gym, whether you run 100 on the track all out, whether you swim a 50 all out, like anytime you go completely max, the effect that that has on your neurological system is kind of really needs to be acknowledged and looked at. And how you, I guess, concepts around how you train that system and how you develop sort of the capacity for more output, but also how you recover from it and how long it, like what the recovery times look like and how you factor that into your training programs. And not only the effect that that has on physiological performance, but also like that it has on you psychologically as well, is very closely linked. And it can severely affect kind of motivation and arousal levels. And you don't really, it's kind of like the silent killer. You don't realize it's at play. You know, it's very difficult to measure. You know, we usually view things through, you know, muscular fatigue or cardiovascular fitness in this space, but trying to develop a greater understand of how, you know, the neural system works and what it takes, as I said, to what it takes to recover from and dissipate the fatigue from that system before you go again is something that we're still, is kind of in its infancy for us. We're learning a ton more about it, but it's also like really unique to the individual as well. So even though we're sort of feel as though we're on the right path with Cam, how I apply that to 7 or 8 other sprinters is certainly my biggest challenge at the moment, because everyone's system's a little bit different. But yeah, look, it's, you know, the central nervous system is at the heart of everything that we do. There's so much literature out there, you know, track and field, sprinting events, I've got a really good grasp on it, the same as, you know, different methods and theories involved in strength and conditioning and lifting and power lifting and stuff like that. I think we're just scratching the surface of those applications into swimming.
How do you measure it?
Well, I mean, it's, yeah, you don't have a, like, you know, it's not like measuring lactate or heart rate or anything like that. So it's a lot of trial and error. And you rely on a lot of, you know, for Cam and I, like I can see it, you know, mood state can definitely be one of them, just how he's moving or where his energy levels are at. I rely on a lot of biofeedback from Cam, obviously, and he's highly, highly aware of it and super conscious of it. So he might be like, oh, I'm feeling like this. And we can say, ah, that's right. Well, that makes sense because of what we did 2 days ago and stuff like that. Like, you know, we obviously have a lot of technology at our disposal as well for the way that we train. So we have a block at the Queensland Academy of Sport, like a diving block that goes into the pool, but it's got a force plate on it that measures everything as well. And one of the indicators that it's kind of like a jump test for freshness, you know, that athletes would use in S&C and, you know, in a gym space. And, you know, if Cam's if he's neurally fatigued and in a lot of work, his numbers are going to be down a little bit. So, you know, his takeoff velocity off the block, his numbers might be down in meters per second. So we can get that, which usually just validates how he's feeling. So yeah, look, there is some like, and there'd be a number of other ways to measure it as well. I'm sort of just speaking in my little space.
Heart rate variability be one of them, like how well he recovers overnight, measuring that heart rate variability at night, like if it's a high number, is that something?
I think that, look, that could be a different, it's not something that we do in this space. You know, we're not monitoring. I don't think Cam would have taken his heart rate at all in the past 3 or 4 years. You know, it's not something that we're looking at. I think definitely resting heart rates or is definitely a response to stress, whether it's training stress or life stress and stuff like that. Heart rate, as we know, is influenced by so many different things on any given day. So, you know, that's for what we're talking about, that's not something that we look at. But I think there's neural fatigue in the short term, and removing that maybe in a 72 to 96 hour window, but it compounds over time as well. And it can take a long time to dissipate that, way longer than, you know, like for Cam, it can be a couple of months of just genuine, like really well-planned rest to just remove those layers after layers after layers and get to that point of just absolute freshness and explosivity and give yourself an opportunity to be as fast as you can possibly be. And not like in swimming, a lot of sports aren't relying upon you being as fast as you can possibly be, because you've got to blend endurance into that. You've got to blend, you know, a number of other things into that. But when we're talking about the 50 that lasts for 20 seconds, and once you take out the dive, it's 15 seconds of free swimming. Like, we've got to be as fresh as we can possibly be neurally. And those impulses have got to be firing, you know?
How does a commoner walk the line of being rested, but not say out of shape, where, you know, you want to break it down, but rest to build it up. But, you know, from this commenter's perspective, I feel like I'm always just trying to grind it to the pieces until I'm like maybe injured or something, you know, like what's your recommendation there?
Yeah. I mean, I guess it comes down to what your goal is. Like Cam talks about it really well, is a lot of people they're afraid of losing conditioning or fitness, not actually for the event that they're preparing for, but for the training week that they usually undertake. So it's like, as you go through a rest or a taper phase, your capacity to actually do what you would normally do in a week is naturally going to decline a little bit. And so they associate that with, oh my God, I'm losing fitness, I'm losing endurance, I'm losing this, that, and the other right now. How am I going to perform? But what they don't realize is they're thinking of it through the prism of like, I'm losing fitness to get through a training week, as opposed to I'm actually freshening up to be able to pour everything into one effort, or, you know, multiple efforts over a couple of days. Again, yeah, that was something I struggled with when I would train. Like I'd get into some running or get back into a little bit of swimming over the years, and like I would just go to breaking point, go too hard too quick. It was just in my nature. So I think as you get a little bit older, you know, really valuing rest and recovery, and it's okay to take a day off. Like you're not going to lose fitness in a day, you're not going to put on 2 kilos in a day, you're not going to, like, your metabolism's not going to shut down, and you're going to lose, like, the old use it or lose it mentality probably. You know, it's just this kind of fear that we have, and it's ingrained into us. I don't know where it comes from, but I don't even know if that explains what we're talking about. But
yeah. You totally nailed it, man. I want to shift gears here before we wrap it up to this. At its core is an aesthetics show. You've seen some of the most beautiful pools in the world. Which pool comes to mind most as like, gosh, that pool, when I swam in it or when I saw that water, I was blown away. And can you describe that water for us?
You know, I've been fortunate to be in almost every body of ocean across the world. I've been in a lot of different swimming pools across the world. And, you know, from a competitive side of things, I've always loved Sydney Olympic Park, where the Sydney Olympics were. I loved a lot of my best swims took place in there, and I've just got a really strong emotional attachment to that facility. There's so much culture and history wrapped up in that building as well. Like every time I go back to Sydney and we have a competition there, I walk in and I can't describe that feeling of knowing what took place in that building, knowing what I've done in that pool, knowing like just all of those experiences. So I just like, that's a place that will always be really special to me. But outside of that, I think, you know, where I'm from, Jervis Bay, New South Wales, there's a pool down there in Huskisson that's right on the water. And it's salt water, you know, so it's fed from the ocean, kind of like what we'd call a rock pool over here. It's kind of a quasi rock pool, like the ones in Sydney and up and down the coast are like genuinely like right in the rocks and sort of shaped around it. This one's structured like a pool, but still feeds in from the ocean. And some of my earliest memories of swimming are down there in that pool. And, you know, these days when I go back home, it's not to get in the water there. It might be sitting at the Husky pub having a beer overlooking the pool. But I could, like, vividly, I could shut my eyes and just still imagine jumping into that salt water. It's a little bit more dense, like the buoyancy that you get. It was always cold down there, but I can still feel it. Like, it doesn't go away. It doesn't go away from you. So I can always contrast my experiences in the water with salt water and then heavily chlorinated pools. They feel completely different. But both of them, just, again, if I shut my eyes and just think from a tactile perspective, like I can instantly feel what it feels like to get a hold on some water in the competitive pools. And I can, yeah, instantly tap straight back into that salt water feel, whether it's in a rock pool or some of the awesome places I've been able to surf over the years as well. So,
man.
So Huskisson, that's where you need to get to. Right?
Okay. Okay. Sick. And follow-up question. You are a surfer first. So What's your number one surf spot that if you could zip right there to it right now, it's just to feel it and get a few, where would that be?
Oh man, that's a good question. There's a bit of a process for me to get to this answer because I'm just going to assume that I don't have free reign of it. So like I'm going to rule out the Gold Coast real quick because there's just 6 billion people in the lineup every single day. So I'm not going to play hypotheticals where we just like we'll just assume it's today, a normal day. I'm definitely going down the south coast of New South Wales, so I'm going home. There's a beach, I think we may have surfed there. I think it's called Wairo Beach, just south of Ulladulla. Beach break, really good on its day, really good peaking waves, lefts and rights, usually really uncrowded, particularly during a work week. Yeah, I've had some awesome surfs there over the years, and it's not too sketchy. It's not some like psycho slabby reef break that we're usually surfing down there as well. It's a place I could probably still paddle into right now and be pretty comfortable. So yeah, I'd say that stretch of beach at Wairo, just south of Ulladulla, I could definitely transport there right now and have some fun.
And I do remember vividly you taking me there. It brought me kind of back to the Carolinas, maybe even the Outer Banks style.
Yeah. Yeah.
You kind of drive up and there's a lot of dunes happening and little peaks up and down the coast, just super fun. What struck me most about that session in particular was it was onshore at one location and then not too far away, it was offshore at this beach. And here, as you know, it's like, it's either onshore or offshore pretty much the whole way. There's no little nooks or crannies that headlands stick out. And that's really, man, what I love so much about where you grew up is that variety of being able to get something really, really good. I mean, I don't know if Pat even goes out unless it's offshore, right? Like he snuffs his nose at it. Like
we're pretty picky.
Yeah, very spoiled. Yeah, that wave Aussie pipe. God, yeah. Dude, like that was one of those experiences. I thank Pat a lot for that, but Tim, this has been really, really amazing. I want to have you on again for part two. You're invited anytime. And like my love for you, my love for your family is deep, and truly thank you for coming on the show.
I appreciate it, mate. You know, we've spoken about doing this for a long time right now, and I didn't really want to get out here before, you know, prematurely. I wanted to sort of let the last couple of years play out. Your interest and support from afar has just always meant the world to me. My family love you. My friends that got to know you over the years still talk about you. Your family's incredible as well. You know, so many similarities between our upbringings and how blessed we are with the families that we have has always been common ground that we have too. And you know, I just a quick shout out to everyone over there on the east coast of the USA that might be listening, particularly in that North Carolina, Wilmington region. You know, so many fond memories, and it's actually take a lot of pride when I see you popping up all over like social medias and your interactions now, like with whether it's UNCW swimming or the surf lifesaving community, like you kind of just pop up somewhere everywhere, and it's awesome to see. Like the stoke that you bring to what you do is super infectious. It's kind of getting me a little bit G'd up right now as well. So I appreciate it, dude. It's been a pleasure. So good to see you.
Dude, and I'm not letting you go yet because I have two short questions that don't need long answers, but they're good. Okay, ready? So what, like, first principles, what makes a great swim coach?
I think it comes down to relationships. It's just human connection, like anything. I think if you had to choose between a coach that was like the most scientific, well-versed in absolutely everything, but had no people skills, as opposed to somebody that was incredible with people skills, but had very limited knowledge base when it came to the actual, I would back the person with people skills every day.
Nice. And what is the meaning of life according to Tim Lane?
Oh, dude, I thought this was going to be a short answer. I think to keep it really simple and just take as many opportunities to look around, be grateful for what you have, not spending much time longing for what you don't have. The meaning for me right now at this stage of my life is just give as much as I can to my wife, my kids, be a great brother, be a great brother to my brother and sister, be a great dad, be a great husband. And, you know, just take it one day at a time. Like I that's all I can do. I don't have a greater, don't think about that much actually. So I'll have to, maybe that's part two, the meaning of life with Tim Lane and Sean Rutke. That could go deep.
Let's do that. It's a date.
that might be one where we can actually have a couple of drinks at the same time.
We'll arrange the timing of the day of our days so that we can do that. And I actually have a Foster's over there I was going to do with this podcast, but we it's a little early here. It's 3:30, 5:30 a.m. where you are. And what are you doing next, Tim? What's on the docket for today?
My son Parker and I were flying down to Sydney to see mum and dad actually. So we're going to do a couple of days down there. Just catch up with them and spend some time, which is going to be really, really nice. So looking forward to getting down there, catching up with some friends on the northern beaches as well. And we don't get many opportunities to reconnect. So just trying to, again, be grateful for this weekend ahead and go have some fun.
Epic. Well, tell your parents I said hello, and I think about them a lot. And Tim, thank you, sir.
Likewise, mate. Straight back to you. Love to you and your family as well. And we'll keep in touch, dude.
We will. And there you have it, folks. That's episode 55 of Speaking From Water. I'm your host, Sean Rutke. That was Tim Lane. What a bro. Bro for life. Until the next time, I wish you good luck. Stay wet. Peace out. And there you have it.
Let's go. How good.
All right.